أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، بارئ الخلائق أجمعين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين، سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد.
اللهم صل على
ثم الصلاة والسلام على آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المكرمين، ولعنة الله على أعدائهم أجمعين من يوم عداوتهم إلى يوم الدين. أما بعد، فقد قال الله تبارك وتعالى في كتابه وهو أصدق القائلين، بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم: واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا، واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها، كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون. صلوات على محمد. Last night we began discussing how theological schools were formed in Islam, and we talked about the concept of al-adala in tashayyu'. And we said that most Muslims in the 7th and 8th centuries onwards, particularly 9th century onwards, when the Abbasid Caliph al-Mutawakkil came to power, he was the most prominent of the Abbasid Caliphs. So in the sense of all the major names amongst the Khulafa in Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas, he would have been the most prominent amongst the last. The Ash'ari school of thought was enforced as the only aqidah that had to be practiced by Muslims, and those who refused this were put to death. It became the theology of mainstream Muslims. Now, with the Ash'ari school, the idea of predestination as opposed to free will, and the insistence that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the cause of all actions, good and bad, was also then infused amongst the Muslim populace. And what we have said is that in our understanding, this was a dangerous idea. The Umayyads as well had latched onto this idea. It wasn't a new idea. But there was a temporary reversal, for example, when Al-Ma'mun became the caliph and he brought back the Al-Mu'tazilite understanding as the dominant aqidah. The Abbasids used this, as the Umayyads did, to argue that because God causes all actions to be and everything works on the basis of predestination, therefore we rule over you by God's will. And they took on this title of Khalifatullah to justify that they were the representatives of God on the earth. Furthermore, to solidify their positions, they forged traditions and attributed them to the Prophet ﷺ to say that if you should be ruled by others after me, even if they do not follow my practice, and even if there are devils in the form of humans, and they usurp your right, and they whip you, and they torment you, and they are absolutely unjust, you must still not rise against them. And doing so is a sin. And it was kufr to rise against the person who ruled over you as your waliul amr. Now, last night I asked this question, if you remember, that as Muslims, if we hold on to the idea that certain texts besides the Quran are also absolutely sahih and their authenticity cannot be doubted, then we are often challenged, such as the question that is asked, that if these sort of traditions are in the authentic sources, how do we reconcile the issue that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam rose against Yazid, but based on the sahihain, it was a sin to rise against Yazid on the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ. What I was trying to imply was this, that even if we suppose and say that Imam al-Bukhari and Imam Muslim were extremely sincere when they compiled their works, and they were pioneers in not only compiling hadith, but in establishing a framework on whose basis you determine what traditions are sahih and what was not. The fact of the matter is that a lot of their criteria and determination of what's sahih and what is not was on the chain of transmitters. A hadith is made up of two blocks, sanad and matn. Sanad is the chain of narrators that links you from your time to the Prophet ﷺ to say, how did this hadith get here? And that is why when you read a full hadith, it will say so-and-so heard from so-and-so, who heard from so-and-so, who heard from so-and-so. The muhaddithun have to study this chain and investigate every individual on that chain and verify if these individuals were authentic, were people of integrity, and if their words can be relied upon. They try and look at the age and times in which these people lived, were there any gaps in the years between these chains of transmitters, and look for any reason to say, did they really exist, what sorts of individuals were there, is it plausible that they were in those times to meet the people from whom they heard, and so on. And then there is the second part, which is the matn, which is the content and the text itself. Our argument is that we cannot simply insist on the sanad, we have to look at the matn as well, and if the content clearly opposes the Quran and what would be considered common sense and logic, such as supporting an unjust ruler or a tyrant, then that should also be a reason to suggest that the hadith is not authentic. And what we have been saying is this, that as Muslims, it is now long overdue that we consider certain things that we have considered to be cast in stone. One of these things is that the Prophet ﷺ never said, there is no hadith that he said, that anyone who sees me even once in my lifetime is my Sahaba. This definition of a Sahaba was created by the scholars later on. And that is why, if you study this, there is a whole study on this as well, as to how did the definition of a Sahaba come to be. And you will see that in Sunni Islam as well, initially the definition of Sahaba was not so broad. But with time, as different questions came about to say, well, if you say this is the definition of a Sahaba, well, then does this person qualify? And if this is the definition of a Sahaba, then what do you say about that person? And as it became difficult to draw a circle around who is Sahaba and who is not, a broad general definition came to be to say anyone who saw the Prophet ﷺ even once as a Muslim was a Sahaba. Now, you can see that at the time that this definition was created, it may have seemed the most easiest and common sense way to define Sahaba. But what we are saying is that in light of the fact that the actions of some of the individuals were very different after the Prophet from what it was before the time of the Prophet, or during the time of the Prophet ﷺ, there is an opportunity here to ask ourselves that if this is not legislated by Quran and there is no hadith from the Prophet to say anyone who saw me even once is a Sahaba, is it time that we perhaps redefine who a Sahaba is and say this is a very simplistic definition. And rather than defining on the basis of anyone who was passing by Medina and saw the Prophet once, perhaps we should define a companion on the basis of character, actions, and what they did in history. This would seem the most logical. And this is what the Shia do. When the Shia say, Ashab of Imam Hussein, Ashab of Imam Ali, Ashab of Imam al-Sadiq, they have this idea that these were individuals who didn't just see the Imam, but these were individuals who were loyal to the household of the Prophet, who agreed to the understandings and the teachings of that Imam, who followed them, and the Imam did not disown them at any point in their lives. And they remained loyal to that Imam even after the Imam passed away. The other thing that we have been saying that deserves re-looking at, and obviously as Shias, it is not our place to say to our Sunni brothers, you should question Bukhari. But we are simply saying that when we define the issues that lead to other issues downstream in the Ummah, these are perhaps points worthy of discussion for the Sunni brothers and sisters amongst themselves. And likewise, they may have points of discussions that they would raise for us that we would consider in our faith. So, one was the issue of Sahaba. The other was the issue that likewise, there is no hadith from the Prophet ﷺ to say that there shall come a man after me whose name shall be Bukhari or Imam al-Bukhari, and he will compile hadith, and whatever he compiles is absolutely authentic and you must not doubt it. There is no such tradition, obviously. And therefore, we should therefore be willing to consider that if Imam al-Bukhari and Imam Muslim were not ma'asum and were not infallible, much as they were sincere in trying to identify what is authentic and what is not, there is a likelihood that what they compiled may have content or has content that is not authentic. When the Shias argue for the isma of their imams and say that the imams from the Ahlul Bayt are ma'asum, they have a point by which they can argue that. They can put forth, for example, the ayat of Tathir from the Quran and say that the Quran vouches for their infallibility and says to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam that innama yuridu Allah, Allah has willed this. And you know, when Allah wills something, innama amruhu idha arada shay'an an yaqula lahu kun fayakun. So innama yuridu Allah liyudhhib ankum Ahlul Bayt. Allah has decreed and willed this, that He shall keep away, O Ahlul Bayt, from you every kind of rijs, any kind of impurity that can be imagined, physical or spiritual. وَيُطَهِّرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. But we cannot argue this for the case of anyone else. And therefore it should not seem so earth-shattering and shocking that we might consider that there is something that Imam al-Bukhari thought was authentic but is not. Now, the concern, as we mentioned earlier, is that if we open up this door to say, could things be wrong in the Sahihain, then it puts the Sharia in jeopardy. It shakes and crumbles the Sharia. I don't speak for the Sunni Muslims, obviously, but to my limited understanding, I would say if this were to happen, yes, it would shake that institution that is in place, but I don't think it would collapse. If anything, I think it will come out stronger. But this is in summary of, you know, what we have said so far. Now, last night we spoke about adala, and tonight we want to now speak about the second principle that the Shias insist on, which is the principle of al-imama, if you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Now, there is this misconception that imama is a Shi'i concept. And a lot of times you will hear brothers and sisters from the Sunni madhab saying that where is imama in the Quran and how do you prove imama? And this is something that you Shia created. This is actually a misnomer. It is a false idea. Imama is very much present in all the Muslim madhabs and in all the ummah. The Sunni Muslims have many traditions from the Prophet ﷺ that says that after me there shall come 12 imams. And these imams shall all be from the Quraysh. And they have other traditions to say that they shall be from the descendants of Fatima alayhi salam. So such traditions are found, and there are Sunni scholars who have attempted to compile a list of who these 12 imams are. But the Shias have raised issues with all of those, issues such as there is no continuity between these 12 imams. Some have simply taken prominent names in the history of the Muslims. So for example, they may have taken the Khulafa al-Rashidun and then taken names like Muawiyah and Harun al-Rashid and Ma'mun and so on. And there are various lists that do exist with this idea. I generally do not like to promote my own lectures or ask you to go back and listen to lectures I have delivered in the past. But because of now, in the interest of time, I will make an exception and say that some 6 years ago, right here at the Masumin Center, I delivered a series of two lectures on imama in Islam. The first one is imamat in Islamic theology, and the second one was imamat in Islamic history. This was around 2011, and you will find this online on YouTube and others. And in these lectures, I have gone into a lot of details to say that in the Ash'ari school, there have been some major names and theologians like Abu Bakr al-Baqilani and At-Taftazani. These were the giants of Ash'ari theology, and they have discussed imamat at great length. As an example, Abu Bakr al-Baqilani, who was a Maliki jurist and a Qadi, Ibn Taymiyyah says, there is no greater Ash'ari theologian than al-Baqilani. And there has never been anyone before him, nor shall there be anyone after him. He is unparalleled and unrivaled in his knowledge of Ash'ari theology. And he wrote 52 volumes defending the Ash'ari theology. Al-Baqilani talks about imamat, conditions, and I've discussed in these two lectures how it starts with the premise of what qualities should an imam have, what disqualifies an imam from being an imam, and how it came down to this final conclusion to say that anyone can be an imam, even an unjust and a tyrannical ruler. If he takes power by force, his imamat is valid and rising against him is a sin. And in those lectures as well, I discussed this very difficult to understand concept that says, if an unjust ruler rules over you, it is wajib to obey him, and it is haram to rise against him. If you rise against him, you commit a sin and a crime. However, if you manage to overthrow him, justly or unjustly, and you take power, then now it becomes wajib to obey you, and anyone who rises against you commits sin and kufr. And I have demonstrated this with proofs and details of who said it and how the whole thing came about. In these lectures, I also explained that when the Shias asked their counterparts, the Sunni theologians, that on what basis does an imam get selected or elected as an imam, and they came up with the definition to say the one who is elected by the Muslim Ummah, by consensus, becomes the imam. And the Shias then said, well, when the first caliph was elected, it was a closed-door session between the Muhajirun and the Ansar. Besides that, there were prominent individuals that were missing at that meeting, such as Ali ibn Abi Talib. Plus, there were others who were opposed to it. Talha was opposed to it. Zubair was opposed to it. These were big names in Islam. The Banu Hashim were opposed to it. The leader of the Khazraj tribe was opposed to it, and so on. Now, they then said, well, anyone who is elected by the elite in the community, the prominent members in the community, becomes an imam. So the Shias then said, well, when the second caliph elected his successor, he did it on his deathbed, and I mean, the first caliph appointed only one individual without consulting the elite in the community. So then they said, well, if the caliph appoints a successor, then that is valid as well. So then the issue of shura came up. And then the issue of how did Muawiyah come to take Khilafat came up. And so all these definitions kept making it very difficult. And what I show in those two lectures is that eventually what the theologians did was they read history and saw how the caliphs had come about. And then in reverse, they came up with a definition to say these are all the possible ways in which one can become a legitimate caliph. And so for our purpose tonight is only to say that the issue of imamat exists in Shia and Sunni Islam. The Shias have a hadith that says, "Man mata walam ya'rif imama zamanihi, mata mitatal jahiliya." Whoever dies without having recognized the imam of his time, he dies the death of ignorance. And when we say jahiliya, we refer to the period of jahala before Islam, which is the period of shirk. Now, the Sunni Muslims also have this hadith, but in their hadith it is even more strictly defined. Imam Ahmad ibn Hanbal reports in his Musnad, "Man mata bighayri imamin mata mitat al-jahiliya." Whoever dies without an imam, he dies the death of jahala. And it is for this reason that you will see that the early Muslims were insistent that they had to have pledged allegiance to someone. And when the Ottoman Empire collapsed, there was a concerted effort in places like India and other places to start a Khilafat movement. And Muslims have continuously been expressing this concern. To this day, there are Muslims who express this concern that we Muslims have not pledged bay'ah to anyone, and therefore we commit a sin. Which is the reason why when ISIS also promoted Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, they set up the idea of a Khilafat and bay'ah. And those who followed were took an interest on that idea, because this idea of Khilafat and Imamat is very much part and parcel of Islam. Now, to give you a quick example of how important having an Imam and having pledged allegiance to an Imam is to Muslims, not Shia Muslims, general Muslims. There is an incident that I discuss in detail in those two lectures, but I will tell you very quickly. The second Caliph Umar had a son, Abdullah bin Umar, who is well known in Islam, and many ahadith are reported from Abdullah bin Umar. He had refused to pay allegiance to Ali bin Abi Talib, but he was very concerned that he did not have a pledge that had been committed to anyone in a position of power. We are told that after Yazid died, and the Umayyads were still in power, but the Sufyanids, they were the Banu Sufyan, children of Abu Sufyan, the dynasty moved within the Umayyad from the family of Sufyan to the family of Marwan, Marwan ibn al-Hakam. And these were now the Marwanids. And one of the first sons of Marwan who ruled was Abdul Malik bin Marwan. When Abdul Malik bin Marwan became the caliph, Abdullah bin Umar was in Iraq. And his governor was Hajjaj bin Yusuf al-Thaqafi. Hajjaj was a brutal, brutal man, and he has a long history of bloodshed. And his favorite pastime was killing the Shias. He used to send men out to say, I feel like murdering a Shia today, go look for one for me. And so they brought Kumail ibn Ziyad. When we recite Dua Kumail, he murdered Kumail. They brought Qambar, the faithful servant of Ali, he murdered Qambar. And Sa'id bin Jubair, and many, many Sadat. When Hajjaj bin Yusuf died, there were tens of thousands of Shias in his prison. Many were in a wretched state. They were naked, they were tortured, they were killed, they were left to die. And as I said, the Abbasids as well tortured the Sadat and the family of the Prophet greatly, burying them alive in walls and using their blood mixed with cement to build their palaces. They even relished in saying, our palaces should be built with the blood of the followers of Ali. Now, when Abdullah bin Umar found out that Abdul Malik bin Marwan has become the caliph, that same night he said, I cannot sleep unless I have done bay'ah to the imam of the time. So he goes to the palace of Hajjaj, and he is told Hajjaj is sleeping. He says, this cannot wait, it has to happen right now. And because he was a prominent individual as the son of the second caliph, he is allowed audience inside, and he goes right into the chamber where Hajjaj is sleeping. Hajjaj wakes up from sleep and says to him, what is so urgent that cannot wait until the sun rises? He said, what is urgent is I have not given bay'ah to the ruler of the time, to the Khalifa and the Imam of the time. You are the governor of Abdul Malik bin Marwan, and I must pledge allegiance right now. Now, Hajjaj was a wretched man, so he can't be bothered to sit up or extend his hand to Abdullah bin Umar. And what he does is he extends his foot to him, and he says, pay allegiance to my foot then. And Mughniyah, in his book that is in English, Despotic Rulers, describes this incident and says Abdullah bin Umar, who had refused to pay allegiance to Ali, took the foot of Hajjaj and kissed it and pledged allegiance to it and said, O Allah, bear witness that if I die tonight, I have not died without having done bay'ah to the Imam of the time. This is not to disparage anyone. Ibn Abil Hadid al-Mu'tazili, the Mu'tazilite scholar who wrote Sharh of Nahjul Balagha, he narrates this incident as well. This is not to disparage anyone, but this is to show that the idea of imamat and pledging allegiance and bay'ah is very much part of Muslims, even if Muslims may have forgotten it. And so you can find more about this, if you want, in those two lectures that I have delivered on the importance of imamat. So, there shouldn't be this argument amongst Muslims, this concept of imamat, where is it in Quran, and this has been created. The question we ask is this. We all have it in our books that the Prophet ﷺ said, after me there will be 12 imams. Al-a'immatu ba'di ithna ashar. And then with the additions, kulluhum min Quraysh, and so on. Now, what is the purpose of these 12 imams? If they come after the Prophet one after the other, and then the 12th one dies, and thereafter the ummah is once again left without an imam. Either the imamate should continue so that until the world exists, one of these 12 is still alive. Or when the 12th one dies, the world should come to an end. Then it makes sense to say that the Prophet was trying to say that my knowledge and this guidance and Islam will continue to have an imam until the end of times, because there is no other prophet or book after this. But if there were imams who came after the Prophet, either continuously or sporadically, and somewhere in the 7th, 8th century, 9th century, the last one dies, and the ummah is now left again orphaned without an imam, then what was the whole idea of saying, after me there will be 12 imams? So this is another issue that needs to be discussed, and inshallah, it is something that we can think about as Muslims, Shia and Sunni, and open it to discussion as well in future. If you can recite Salawat ala Muhammad wa ala. I now want to jump on to a different segment of this discussion, which I hinted at yesterday, which is to say, the imams in the madhab of Shia are all related to each other, father, son. There is only one difference, that after Ali bin Abi Talib is his elder son Al-Hasan, and then it's his brother Al-Husayn. And after Imam Al-Husayn, it goes from father to son until the final Imam, Al-Hujjat Al-Qa'im, Ajjalallahu Ta'ala, Farajahu Sharif. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. Ruhi wa arwahu al-alamina laka al-fida sayyidi. Now, what is the difference between this idea of imams being in one family, father and son, and the idea of a monarchy and nepotism, whether it's Umayyads or Abbasids back then, or whether it's Al Saud today? What is the difference? The difference is that this lineage and father and son is attested for and vouched for in the Quran. And this is what I want to show you, that this is not a hereditary thing. I did mention previously that when Allah revealed to His Prophet ﷺ and said to him, when He revealed to the Muslims that, O Muslims, Allah and His Messenger sent blessings on the Prophet, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا صَلُّوا عَلَيْهِ وَسَلِّمُوا تَسْلِيمًا اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. The Prophet ﷺ taught the Muslims how to send salam on him. He said, say, قُولُوا اللَّهُمَّ صَلِّ عَلَى مُحَمَّدْ وَآلِ مُحَمَّدْ كَمَا صَلَّيْتَ عَلَى إِبْرَاهِيمِ وَآلِ إِبْرَاهِيمِ. O Allah, send blessings on Muhammad and Ali Muhammad as you sent blessings on Ibrahim and the Al of Ibrahim. Now this is very, very important that Ibrahim and Al Ibrahim are mentioned as we develop this. I also mentioned last night that there are two verses in the Quran where Allah talks about the Ummah. In one verse, which is in Surah Ali Imran, chapter 3, verse 110, He says, كُنْتُمْ خَيْرَ أُمَّةٍ أُخْرِجَتْ لِلنَّاسِ. You are the best Ummah that has ever been brought forth from the human species, from mankind. And in Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 143, He says, وَكَذَلِكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا. Thus we have made you the middle nation. And all the Mufassirun, Shia and Sunni, say that أُمَّةً وَسَطًا means the best Ummah. This is the meaning of أُمَّةً وَسَطًا, the tafsir of it. Why? لِتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ, so that you may be witnesses over all mankind. وَيَكُونَ الرَّسُولُ عَلَيْكُمْ شَهِيدًا, and Rasul will then be a witness over you. Now, when you read Sunni tafsir, what they say is that the Muslims are the best Ummah because they are the middle nation amongst the monotheists between Jews and Christians. The Jews have taken rituals and forgotten the spirituality of religion, and the Christians have taken a spiritual idea and left Sharia and the laws. The Muslims have taken both, and therefore they are a middle nation. And therefore the Muslim Ummah shall bear witness over the Jews and Christians on the Day of Judgment, and then the Prophet will bear witness on the Muslim Ummah. Now, I want you to park these thoughts and ideas in your mind for a moment, and now I want to talk about something else. Now, I will, if time permits tonight, say that I have this whole discussion where we ask our Muslim brothers and sisters who are not Shia, what would be the reason why the Prophet ﷺ would not appoint a successor? Because there is no hadith from the Prophet ﷺ that says, I am not appointing a successor, or Allah has told me not to appoint a successor. How is it conceivable to you that months before at Ghadir, he said to the Muslims, I'm leaving soon, this is my farewell pilgrimage, this is Hajjatul Wida. In Medina, he told them, every year Jibreel comes to me and recites the Quran with me. This year he recited with me twice, and therefore I know I'm leaving. He didn't pass away suddenly. He fell ill on a Thursday, he passed away on a Monday. Everyone knew he was passing away, which is why they did not join the army of Osama. Yet no one thought it wise to ask the Prophet, what should we do after you? And the Prophet also is not telling them what to do after. Yes, there is the Prophet ﷺ telling them, give me a paper and pen, I may write something, you will not go astray after me. But he is denied the paper and pen. So what would be the possible reason why the Prophet ﷺ and Allah would not want a successor appointed? Now, when I talk about it separately, I will give you all the various reasons. But the predominant reason that is given is this, that the Prophet ﷺ lived at a time when the Arabs were very tribalistic. And he did not want to promote this idea of tribalism and dynasties, where if he appointed someone from his family, then it will set this precedence of tribalism in the Muslim Ummah. Now, he wanted a more democratic leadership, where the Ummah would consult amongst themselves and decide amongst themselves who is the best person to lead them. Okay. Now, the first thing we observe when we read the Quran is that Allah, when He talks about all His guides, they all seem to be related by blood. In Surah Ali Imran, chapter 3, verse 33, He says, "Inna Allah astafa Adama wa Nuhan wa Ala Ibrahim wa Ala Imran ala al-alamin." Allah has selected, istafa from Mustafa means to select. Allah selected Adam and Nuh. And then He selected the progeny of Ibrahim and the progeny of Imran over all of humanity and mankind. The verse doesn't, the surah doesn't end. ذُرِّيَّةً بَعْضُهَا مِنْ بَعْضٍ وَاللَّهُ سَمِيعٌ عَلِيمٌ. All of them, descendants from descendants, some related to the other as descendants, and Allah is all-hearing and all-knowing. Now listen to this, it's a longer passage. This is in Surah Al-An'am, chapter 6, verses 83-87. تِلْكَ حُجَّتُنَا آتَيْنَاهَا إِبْرَاهِيمَ عَلَىٰ قَوْمِهِ. It continues from the previous verse and says, that was our proof that we gave Ibrahim over his people. نَرْفَعُ دَرَجَاتْ مَنْ نَشَاءُ. We elevate in status whomever we please. إِنَّ رَبَّكَ حَكِيمٌ عَلِيمٌ. Your Lord is all-wise and all-knowing. وَوَهَبْنَا لَهُ إِسْحَاقَ وَيَعْقُوبَ. And we gave Ibrahim, Ishaq, and Yaqub. كُلًّا هَدَيْنَا. All of them we guided. وَنُوحًا هَدَيْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِ. And Nuh as well we guided before. هَدَيْنَا مِنْ قَبْلِ. وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِهِ. And from the descendants and progeny of Ibrahim, دَاوُودَ وَسُلَيْمَانَ وَأَيُّوبَ وَيُوسُفَ وَمُوسَى وَهَارُونَ. وَكَذَلِكَ نَجْزِ الْمُحْسِنِينَ. And this is how we reward those who do good. وَزَكَرِيَّ وَيَحْيَى وَعِيسَى وَإِلْيَاسَ كُلٌّ مِّنَ الصَّالِحِينَ. All of them from the righteous ones. وَإِسْمَعِيلَ وَيَسَعَ وَيُونُسَ وَلُوطًا وَكُلًّا فَضَّلْنَا عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ. All of them we gave excellence over the whole of humanity and the world. Now, وَمِنْ آبَائِهِمْ. And from their fathers. وَذُرِّيَّاتِهِمْ. And from their descendants. وَإِخْوَانِهِمْ. And from their brothers. وَاجْتَبَيْنَاهُمْ. We selected them. وَهَدَيْنَاهُمْ إِلَىٰ صِرَاطٍ مُسْتَقِيمٍ. And then we guided them to the right path. اللهم صلِّ على محمد وعلى محمد. Can you see what Allah is saying? He is saying that guidance is not just I pick someone randomly and say, I'm going to make you a prophet. There is something to be said about the DNA of a prophet, the genealogy, the bloodline, the shajar. So when he created the human species, what he's saying is, in this species, I have taken one line of descent, and from this, their fathers, their brothers, their sons, I pick out and I guide them and give them excellence over all humanity. So in terms of guidance, those who are selected by Allah cannot be equated to the idea of tribalism and nepotism and monarchy and dynasties. Now, the other thing we notice is that the early prophets, Adam, Nuh, and all, when they came, the world kept flip-flopping between obedience to God and disobedience. By the time Ibrahim alayhi salam came, the world was steeped in idol worship. Ibrahim is called the father of monotheism. He is the champion of Tawheed. He stands up alone and fights the whole world to revive the idea that there is only one God, the idea of Tawheed. Which is why in one verse of the Quran, Allah refers to Ibrahim as a nation unto himself. That Ibrahim was an ummah in himself. Ibrahim was constantly being tested and constantly surrendering to Allah. And his Islam was constantly being elevated. He was thrown into the fire. He was asked to slaughter his son. He was asked to leave his wife and a son in a desert without water. He is constantly being tried because he is being purified and brought closer to Allah. And then Allah says, all the descendants are from the dhuriya of Ibrahim. Now, as Ibrahim was being elevated, he had one thing that constantly preoccupied him, and that was that in my descendants, there should be others who are like me. Now, we see, for example, in one place in the Quran, Allah says that we gave Ibrahim and others from his descendants lisana sidqin, that when they spoke, they had the ability to convey the truth. But we see elsewhere that Ibrahim asks Allah, waj'alli lisana sidqin fil akhirin, that, oh Allah, keep this tongue that speaks the truth in my posterity as well. When Allah tried him, and he asked him to slaughter his son, and he came out successfully, now Allah says, وَإِذِ ابْتَلَى إِبْرَاهِيمَ رَبُّهُ بِكَلِمَاتٍ, and your Lord tried Ibrahim with some words. فَأَتَمَّهُنَّ, and he fulfilled those trials and those promises. Now Allah said to him, قَالَ إِنِّي جَاعِلُكَ لِلنَّاسِ إِمَامًا, O Ibrahim, I now make you an imam over people. He should have showed gratitude to Allah and said, elevate my status higher. Immediately, without a pause, what does Ibrahim reply? He says, قَالَ وَمِن ذُرِّيَّتِي, oh Allah, will there be imams in my progeny as well? You see Ibrahim's preoccupation. Now Allah promises him that I will keep the imams in your progeny, but on one condition. قَالَ لَا يَنَالُ أَحْدِ الظَّالِمِينَ, the unjust from your progeny will not be imams. So the Banu Umayyah and Banu Abbas are descendants from Ibrahim. But this right away tells you that the hadith that says that the Prophet said that the rulers after me who are unjust are valid rulers cannot be true, because the Ahad of Allah cannot reach the Zalimeen. And Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, he says, إِنَّ اللَّهَ اتَّخَذَ إِبْرَاهِيمَ نَبِيًّا قَبْلَ أَن يَتَّخَذَهُ رَسُولًا, Allah made Ibrahim a Nabi before he made him a Rasul. وَاتَّخَذَ إِبْرَاهِيمَ رَسُولًا قَبْلَ أَن يَتَّخَذَهُ خَلِيلًا, and he took Ibrahim as, he made him an apostle, a messenger, before he made him a friend. And after he had made him a friend, he tried him. And after he had tried him, then he said, قَالَ إِنِّي جَعِلُكَ لِلنَّاسِ Imama. So this was a very high rank. It was higher than after Ibrahim had become Nabi, Rasul, and all that. At that point, he is being made an Imam. Now, in Surah Al-Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 127 to 129, Allah paints a very graphic picture where He shows us that now Allah, Ibrahim was tested with slaughtering Ismail, and Ismail survived, and Ismail has grown up to be a young man. Now Allah tells Ibrahim, go to Mecca and restore the Kaaba. Now, the picture here is Ibrahim and Ismail are building the Kaaba. Ibrahim is standing on a stone, Maqam Ibrahim. Ismail is passing him the stones, and Ibrahim is placing them and building the Kaaba. And as he is doing it, he is praying to Allah. Now listen to this. وَإِذْ يَرْفَعُ إِبْرَاهِيمَ الْقَوَائِدَ مِنَ الْبَيْتِ. And when Ibrahim was raising the foundation of the house, وَإِسْمَعِيلَ, and Ismail was with him. رَبَّنَا تَقَبَّلْ مِنَّا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ السَّمِيعُ الْعَلِيمُ. And this is very beautiful. It doesn't say qala, because it is to show, to bring that graphic image into your mind, that while he is doing it, there is such intense submissiveness and humility that while they're building, Ibrahim is saying, my Lord, accept this from us. Indeed, you are one who hears and knows. رَبَّنَا وَجَعَلْنَا مُسْلِمَيْنِ لَكْ. O Allah, make me and my son Ismail, not Muslims, submissive to you. Give us a higher station of submission. You see, it doesn't say وَجَعَلْنَا مُسْلِمَيْن. It says مُسْلِمَيْنِ لَكَ. And all the Mufassirun say, he is asking for a higher... It is not possible that at this point Ibrahim is asking Allah that make me and Ismail Muslims. Because Ismail has grown up now. He has already sacrificed Ismail. He has left Ismail and his mother in the desert. He has been thrown into the fire. He is not saying make me a Muslim from a mushrik. وَجَعَلْنَا مُسْلِمَيْنِ لَكَ. Make me and Ismail even more submissive to you.
وَمِنْ ذُرِّيَّتِنَا أُمَّةً مُسْلِمَةً لَكْ.
And from our progeny as well, let there be an ummah that is also muslimatan lak. And Mufassirun will tell you from an Arabic grammar perspective, because it is one statement, therefore, in the same sense that Ibrahim was asking for him and Ismail to be muslimatan lak, in that same sense, he is asking that there should be an ummah from his progeny that is equally submissive to you. Because it is one statement, muslimatan lak. But he wants it to be an ummah that is from his dhurriya. You can see how preoccupied he is with the idea that it should remain in his progeny.
وَأَرِنَا مَنَاسِكَنَا وَتُبْ عَلَيْنَا إِنَّكَ أَنْتَ التَّوَّابُ الرَّحِيمُ رَبَّنَا وَابْعَثْ فِيهِمْ رَسُولًا مِّنْهُمْ.
And Allah send a messenger to these people who purifies them, teaches them the book. And that prayer is answered in Surah Al-Jum'ah. Now,
Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, salawatullahi wa salamu alayhi, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
He says, look, it is not possible to say that when Allah says, وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا, we have made you a middle nation, that you may be witnesses over all mankind, and the Prophet may be a witness over you, that this refers to the whole ummah. He says to his companion, do you not know that amongst Muslims there are some who are so deceitful that you cannot trust them with a handful of dates? If they bear witness about a handful of dates, a sa'a of dates, their witness, their shahada is not trustworthy. And the ayat that says, and we made you a middle nation, ummatan wasata, litakunu shuhada'i ala nas, it does not qualify it and say, we have made the righteous amongst you to be the best nation, that you may be witnesses over people. It is says, all of this ummatan wasata shall be witnesses over people. So Imam al-Sadiq argues and says, it's not possible that it covers the whole Muslim ummah. And then he goes to explain. He says, we, the Ahlul Bayt, we are the ummatan wasata. We shall bear witness over all the deeds of mankind. And the Prophet, our grandfather, shall bear witness to us. And it is we that Allah refers to when he says, kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas. You are the best ummah that has ever been brought forth from mankind. Because when you look at all the verses where God talks of bringing forth prophets and excelling them over humanity, He is talking of an exclusive group. The proof that Imam al-Sadiq gives that this khayra ummatin is with Ahlul Bayt and this ummatan wasata is with Ahlul Bayt is that Ibrahim had prayed for this. That just as you make me and Ismail muslimatan lak, I am asking you, O Allah, wa min dhurriyatina ummatan muslimatan lak. So that prayer of Ibrahim that in my dhurriya there should be an ummah. The same word ummah that Ibrahim is praying for is in kuntum khayra ummah and wakadhalika ja'alnakum ummatan wasata. This is the Shia argument to say that you cannot make it universal and say the whole of humanity is pious, all the Muslim ummah will be witnesses over mankind. This is an exclusive ummah that is chosen from one lineage by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be the guides for humanity and to be the witnesses over their actions, over whom the Prophet will bear witness, and they are the best of all of God's creation from His humanity. If you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad. Now, two more points on this. Allama Tabatabai in his Tafsir al-Mizan makes this point. He says, if you see the word as well, how Allah puts it, he says, kuntum khayra ummatin ukhrijat linnas. Ukhrijat suggests pulling out, bringing forth. He says, it gives the imagery of, it evokes the image of a nation that is being introduced by Allah, just like vegetation on the earth that is brought forth from Allah, where a similar term is used in another verse of the Quran. So it gives this idea that Allah Himself creates all of humanity and from them He pulls out one nation and says to this nation that Ibrahim had asked me from his dhurriya an ummah that is as submissive to me as he was, I shall make you that submissive nation. You are the best nation that has ever been brought forth for humanity and you shall be its guides and you shall be its witnesses. And the Prophet shall bear witness on you, and you shall then be my representatives to humanity. Now, to seal this argument, there is a verse of the Quran in Surah Al-Hajj, chapter 22, verse 78, where Allah says, وَجَاهِدُ فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ وَهُوَ اجْتَبَاكُمْ. He is talking to a select group of people. And the Muslims say he is talking to all the Muslims. But is he talking to all the Muslims? Listen to this. Allah says, and strive in the way of Allah, وَجَاهِدُ فِي اللَّهِ حَقَّ جِهَادِهِ, as He deserves to be strove for. هُوَ اجْتَبَاكُمْ, it is He who has chosen you. وَمَا جَعَلَ عَلَيْكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ مِنْ حَرَجٍ. مِلَّةَ أَبِيكُمْ إِبْرَاهِيمِ, the creed, the deen, the millah of your father Ibrahim. We are not all children of Ibrahim. We are all Muslims. We are all part of the Muslim ummah. But we are not, we cannot all claim our father is Ibrahim. Allah is clearly saying He chose you. اجتباكم ملتا أبيكم إبراهيم. Your father Ibrahim, هو سماكم مسلمين من قبل وفي هذا. It is He who named you Muslims now and before. ليكون الرسول شهيدا عليكم. So that the Prophet may be a witness over you. وَتَكُونُ شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ, and you may be witnesses over people. So that verse had said, you are the ummatan wasata, that you may be a witness over mankind, and the Prophet may be a witness over you. It just said ummatan wasata. This verse is saying, so that the Prophet may be a witness over you, and you may be a witness over people, but it is directly referring to them and saying, your father Ibrahim. So it is not the whole ummah. So what we say now is this, that if you agree with us that the Imams after the Prophet are 12, and if you agree with the Quran that Ibrahim had prayed for an ummah that is as submissive to him as he was submissive to God, we present to you 12 Imams from the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Bring your list of 12 Imams who are as submissive to Allah as Ibrahim was. And let us decide as brothers and sisters which of these 12 were as submissive to Allah as Ibrahim and Ismail were. And whoever we conclude on, by Allah we will follow him and become one ummah. One more. your salawat ala
Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
You don't even have to give 12 names. Just show us, because it's not possible that Allah did not answer the prayer of Ibrahim. In that same set of verses, he asked that send a prophet to these people, and Allah replied it. In Surah Jum'ah, he confirms that the prophet is the answer to Ibrahim's prayer. So we don't even ask for 12 names. We are saying only this much. Guide us to that ummah from the dhurriya of Ibrahim that is muslimatan lak, and we shall follow that. I now have to shift to a different subject. So that is the discussion, that imamat descendants is not hereditary and nepotism. This discussion will now continue tomorrow, but I just want to initiate it for 5 or 10 minutes, inshallah, and then come towards masaib. We're now going to begin discussing as respectfully as we can and as sincerely as we can, in the interest of uniting the Ummah, the issue of that, since we have introduced Adala and Imama from the Tashayyu perspective, and we have argued the rights of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, that they are not merely people to honor and love and praise and recite Na'at and follow in spirituality, but they are the guides of the Ummah, and their aqidah is to be followed, and they are the repositories of the knowledge of the Prophet. We now want to look at what happened in history at a very high level, some early history, some later history, to the present times, and say, would history have been different, and would the Ummah have been in a different state if they would have followed the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam? In order to do that, we will, unfortunately, have to present the Shia objections to how those who ruled instead of the Ahlul Bayt ruled. And we will not do this to disparage them, but to just show the difference and where the Imams from the Ahlul Bayt had a concern and where they raised objection. We were going to do a very detailed analysis of what was the climate in Medina just before Rasulullah ﷺ passed away and immediately after. But at a high level, we can say this, that when the Prophet of Islam began preaching in Mecca, his followers were very few. They were the downtrodden, they were the poor, they were the slaves. But they were extremely sincere. The Quraysh were torturing them, but they were not giving up their faith. Many of them left their homes and went to Abyssinia with Ja'far, the brother of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they stayed there as refugees for a while and came back much later in Medina at the Battle of Khaybar. There was tremendous amount of sacrifices. When the Prophet ﷺ realized now Mecca is no longer safe, he encouraged the Muslims to migrate to Medina. They had to leave their homes, they had to leave their possessions, they had to leave everything and flee overnight. And everything they left behind was looted by the Quraysh. This is not a small feat. Our salams on those Ashab and Ansar of the Prophet. There are very few of us today who would do that and leave. Imagine today, if you, for the sake of your faith, leave everything you have in the bank, leave everything you have at home, just the shirt on you, overnight, immediately, leave to another land and forget everything you ever owned. And in many cases, even leave your family behind. This was tremendous sacrifice. These came to be known as the Muhajirun. When they came to Medina, the people who received them were equally sincere. They were the Ansar. The Ansar, to use a proverbial term, gave the shirt off their back for these Muhajirun. They welcomed them into their homes. The Prophet ﷺ united them and linked them as brothers. He took one Muhajir and one Ansar, one Muhajir and one Ansar, and made them together. He only left Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam and said, Ali bin Abi Talib will be my brother. Everyone else was linked. These Ansar immediately said, whatever I possess, I give half of it to my Muhajir brother. How many of us would do this? Whether you have $1 million in the bank, or whether you have $500,000 in the bank, or whether you have $50,000 in the bank. How many of you, if a Muslim refugee came from another land here, would say, I'm going to divide what I have in the bank in half and give it to him? This is what the Ansar did. Our salams be to the Ansar
and ashab of the Prophet in Medina. These were the most extreme sincere individuals you could find. The Prophet, with their help, built a government. He built a mosque. The Quraysh kept coming after them. The Battle of Badr came. The Ansar of Medina and Muhajirun went out and fought. They were outnumbered. They were 300, the Quraysh were 1,000. They were poorly equipped, but they fought on the basis of Iman and Taqwa and that Allah is with us. And they kept fighting and fighting. There was so much poverty that we are told sometimes two Muslim brothers would share one date, one khajur. They would break it in half. One Sahaba would eat half, the other would eat half. In Makkah, in the Sha'b Abu Talib, there are reports to say that some of the ashab of the Prophet were so poor, they used to look for a dead animal, like a camel, and take the skin of that camel, and they used to pound that skin and make it powder, and from that powder they would mix it with water to make some kind of a dough and eat that. And they lived with thistles and thorns. For what? That the word of Allah may be supreme. These were the ashab of the Prophet. Now, the first sign of things beginning to decline was when Muslims fought the Battle of Khaybar. What happened in Khaybar is that the Jews were extremely wealthy and they had 7 forts. When Muslims won the Battle of Khaybar, a tremendous amount of wealth came into the Ummah. And we now have reports from individuals like Imam Ali alayhi salam who expressed this concern that things will now be different, because it is seen in humans that when their social circumstances change and they become wealthy, they are distracted by the world. But still, Muslims were sincere. There were sporadic incidents we have talked about, like at the Battle of Hudaybiyah, the attempts to assassinate the Prophet at Tabuk and so on. But these were a small group that you might say. For the most part, the Muslims were very sincere. The real problem, in my understanding of history, was when Fath Makkah happened. What happened at Fath Makkah is the Prophet ﷺ took a tremendous army of Muslims and went to Makkah. This was 8 AH. 8 AH after 8 years after Hijrah means 2 years before the Prophet ﷺ passes away, because his wafat is Safar of 11 AH. So it's just 2 months in the year 11 AH. So really 2 years after. Allah would not have left Makkah that Ibrahim built filled with idols in the Kaaba. So Makkah had to be cleaned and restored. The Prophet ﷺ comes to Makkah with a huge army. Here, his arch enemy is Abu Sufyan. And the people there are polytheists, still opposed to the Prophet and to Islam, but now much weakened. Abu Sufyan surrenders Makkah to the Prophet ﷺ. If the Prophet ﷺ would have killed Abu Sufyan and the prominent members of Makkah, then history would write that when Muhammad got power, he became bloodthirsty. And it would set a precedence in the Ummah that when you take power over others and polytheists, you slaughter them. So he gave them amnesty. And in the custom of the Arabs, if you surrender, you become the slave of the one you surrender to. He freed them all. Which is why the daughter of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ummul Masaib Zainab alayhi salam, when she is taken as a prisoner to Sham, and she delivers a powerful sermon, in that court where the Umayyads are basking in glory as the leaders of the Muslim world, she addresses them and says, "Sons of freed slaves, it was my grandfather who freed you. You are our slaves, we freed you." Now, this broke the back of the Quraysh. For centuries, or for a long time, the Quraysh were the masters of Arabia. Suddenly now, the no-names in Medina, the Muhajir and Ansar, became the leaders of Arabia. They now had Makkah and Medina in their control. Now they were a power to reckon with. And they became the dominant force in the Middle East. The Quraysh were reduced. But their dissatisfaction against the Prophet continued. The proof of that is that after Fath Makkah, there was one more battle that was fought outside Mecca that is called the Battle of Hunain. And Allah refers to this in the Quran. He says, "Remember when you went out fighting at the Battle of Hunain, وَأَعَجَبَتْكُمْ كَثْرَتُكُمْ, and because now you were such a large army, you were so impressed by your own force and you thought nothing will cause you loss.
And then the enemies, there were some tribes outside Makkah that came out to fight the Prophet after Fath Makkah. There was a narrow pass between the mountains where they trapped the Muslims. And the Muslims began fleeing once again. And the Quran says, and remember when the Prophet kept calling out to you, asking you to come back, but you turned your back on him and kept running. And it was Allah who gave you victory. Now, after the Muslims won this battle, there was again tremendous amount of war booty that came in. When this wealth came in, the Prophet ﷺ knew that Abu Sufyan and the people in Makkah, the leaders of Makkah, are still inimical to Islam. So what he did was, when he was dividing the booty, this is Islamic history, he gave extra to them. And they came to be known as Mu'allafatil Qulub. These were people, in order to make their hearts have some love towards Islam, you could say in a sense they were being bought out. But the idea was that perhaps if they receive this extra share over other Muslims, their hearts might soften towards Islam. The very, very sincere Ansar who came from Medina were hurt by this. They said to Rasulullah, we have supported, they started talking amongst themselves. The Prophet had no one to support him. He was with a small group of oppressed place in Mecca. He came to Medina. We gave shelter. We sacrificed our lives. We did everything for Islam. And now when Mecca is ours and Islam has grown to such an empire, when the wealth is being divided, we are getting less. And these who are the enemies of Islam, they are getting so much. Now go read the history. You will see that the Prophet ﷺ, when he heard this, he called his Ansar. And he gave a very moving speech to them. If you read that speech, you will weep. He said to them, O my Ansar, if you wish, you can say that Muhammad had no one to help him and we helped him. If you wish, you can say that Muhammad was oppressed and we rescued him. If you wish, you can say that we fought for Muhammad. If you wish, you can say, and he said all that. He said, but are you not satisfied that these people will take the camels and the gold and the goats, but you will take me back with you to Medina? And when the Ansar heard this, they began to weep. And they said, we do not want anything, Ya Rasulullah. We have got you. And he promised them that even though I was a Meccan, and Mecca is my watan, and I long for Mecca, I will go back with you, Medina, and I will be buried with in Medina in your midst. And they were overjoyed. So now he took them back to Medina. Now, the reason I'm saying all this is because tomorrow night, when I begin discussing the Khilafat of Abu Bakr, the first caliph, both Shia and Sunni are in agreement that he was not ma'asum. So even if you judge him with the best of intentions to say once he took power, he was trying to do the best he could, you must concede that he may have made decisions that were detrimental. The point I will argue tomorrow is that there are two decisions that the caliph made that proved to be a disaster in the ummah going down. The first thing was that in order to consolidate the power, what happened is when Abu Bakr became the caliph, there were many tribes outside Medina who said, we're not going to pay zakat anymore. We had an agreement with the Prophet, we were paying zakat, we're not going to pay him. And what Abu Bakr did was, he decided he will fight them, and he went to war against the Muslim tribes who refused to pay zakat. And these are known in history as the Ridda Wars, Hurub Ridda. You can search this, the whole Wikipedia on this. And we're told even the Caliph Umar was surprised at this, and said to Abu Bakr that the Prophet never did this. Are you going to go to war to collect zakat? And he said, yes, I will do it. Now, to consolidate power, what the Caliph Abu Bakr did was, for some reason, he made this judgment that I will not be able to use the Ansar because they are of no name and status. He brought all the prominent names from Makkah and gave them positions of authority. People like Khalid bin Walid. Khalid bin Walid is the one at Uhud who turned around and attacked the Muslims from the other side. Muslims today praise him as Saifullah, the sword of Allah. But I shall mention things regarding Khalid bin Walid tomorrow, and you decide if he is Saifullah. So he brought people like this. He brought the descendants of Abu Sufyan back to power. people like Muawiyah. And when you trace these down history, you find this is how Muawiyah came to rule over Syria. He was appointed as a governor of Syria by the second Caliph Umar. Now here is what I'm trying to show you. That the Prophet ﷺ fought the Quraysh all his life. He diminished and weakened their power and broke their back. He did this on the basis of his most sincere Sahaba, the Muhajirun and the Ansar. Because he argued on this basis and he relied on this basis that as long as we have taqwa and iman and we put our trust on Allah, we don't need the social status and the standing. We can rely on our trust in Allah to fight our enemies. For some reason, the Caliph Abu Bakr, instead of following that policy and saying, we as Muslims, following our sincerity and on the iman and taqwa of the Ansar and Muhajirun, we shall spread Islam, he went back to the old Quraysh leaders and said, we need your help to build Islam. And they obviously came in, but some of them, you may not judge them thus, but the Shia judge them that, came in with now ideas of expansionism, taking land, building power, and restoring wealth. The Quraysh had fought the Prophet not because he said there was one God. They fought the Prophet for economic reasons as well, because Mecca was an economic powerhouse. People used to come from far and wide for pilgrimage to Mecca and offer gifts to the idols and put gold on the idols and so on. They told the Prophet, we can add your Allah to our 365 idols. Their problem was not that Allah was being emphasized. The problem was that the idols were being opposed. Now when their back broke, their eyes must have lit up. They must have thought, well, now we can't make money through the idols, but now we can make money this way. I am probably being a little unfair for those who think of Muawiyah and Yazid as Sahaba, but nonetheless, this is our understanding as the Shia. Now, when they came into power, there was a lot that went wrong. Karbala would not have happened if Muawiyah had not become the governor of Syria. If the early caliphs would not have allowed the Quraysh to come back to power and would have kept their role at a minimum and relied on the household of the Prophet and realized that in all the battles Allah gave us victory through Ali bin Abi Talib and we can rely on the Ahlul Bayt and the sincere Muhajirun and Ansar, then many things would have happened. One is that Islam would not have been accused of spreading by the sword. Secondly, there would have been guidance from this sincerity. And you will see when I talk about the Khilafat of Amir al-Mu'mineen that he was accused of not being wise politically because he was asking all, there were people who advised him that until you consolidate your power, don't start writing letters and saying to Muawiyah, stop being the governor and you come off the governorship and you come off the governorship. But he said, no, they all have to step down. Ammar Yasir will be my governor. Salman Farisi will be my governor. He was sending people who were not politically experienced to be the governors of different lands. Why? Because in Ali's understanding of Islam and the Prophet, leadership must remain with those who have taqwa first. They will learn the political ropes in time and not by politicians on whom you will rely to become muttaqi, which they will never will. Because what is at stake here is not temporal rule, but Islam that is to remain forever on the earth. So this is something we will try and develop as much as tomorrow will allow, and we shall see where this goes. The other issue, and I will conclude with this, that was disastrous in the Ummah is that the Khilafat and the government of Abu Bakr downplayed the role of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Immediately, for example, Fadak was taken away and there was an argument between the daughter of the Prophet and Abu Bakr. Sahih Muslim and Bukhari have reports from Aisha herself to say that Fatima alayhi salam came and asked my father for her right to Fadak and other inheritance. And my father said to Fatima that I heard the Prophet saying that we prophets are not inherited nor do we inherit. And then she says, Fatima remained angry with my father until she passed away. Now, there are many ways in which our Sunni brothers and sisters explain this. Some of them have said there is only one report that says she was angry. Most of them says she was silent. So all it means is she never spoke to him, but it doesn't mean she was angry with him. Others say that Abu Bakr went to see her and he kept talking to her and explaining her and, you know, trying to make her feel better until she was pleased with him. But the point is, even if you argue she was pleased with him, he still did not give her what she was demanding, which means if you judge that case, then it means that wal-iyadu billah, she was wrong in her claim, or she was lying in her claim, that the Prophet had given this to me in my lifetime, and the Caliph was right. Now, for the Shias, the issue is this, that the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam's tahara and isma is vouched for in the Quran, in the ayat of Tathir. And therefore, it was wrong for the Caliph to ask Fatima that bring me witnesses as proof. The Quran has given you that proof. This was not an ordinary person asking you and saying, oh Abu Bakr, this is my right. This is the daughter of the Prophet. The ayah of Mubahala, from which the Ahlul Kisar defined from ayat, the ayat of Mubahala says, bring your nafs, bring your women, bring your children, and the Prophet only took Ali, Fatima, Hassan, and Hussein. He didn't take anyone else. And we are told in the books of the Muslims that when the Christians of Najran saw the faces of these five individuals, they refused to engage in an imprecation in the Mubahala. And they said, by Allah, we see such faces in front of us that if they were to pray to God for mountains to move from their place, mountains will move from their place. These are Christians who are seeing the Ahlul Bayt only once. And Fatima alayhi salam's face is covered. But they can see the radiation of Noor. Now, I mentioned a couple of nights ago, a poet, Shaheed Sibte Jafar. And if you remember, I talked of a poetry of his that starts with Ashab, Thekya, Buzaro, Salman, waghaira. In that he has a line where he refers to this. He says, Jutlate hai jo Fatima, hasneino Ali ko. Jutlate hai jo Fatima, hasneino Ali ko. The unse to behtar banu Najran waghaira. What he's asking is that Banu Najran, a Christian community, can see that these are special. Why you, O Muslims, were not able to see the status of the Ahlul Bayt? Allah, if you read the Quran, and this is final, I promise. Allah in the Quran says that every prophet said to his people, La as'alukum alayhi ajran, in ajriya illa ala Allah. I don't ask you for any ajr, my ajr is with Allah. Only this prophet said, قُلْ لَا أَسْأَلُكُمْ عَلَيْهِ أَجْرًا إِلَّا الْمَوَدَّةَ فِي الْقُرْبَى. I don't ask you for any reward, O my ummah. I want only one thing, that you love my qurba. And Zamakhshari in his tafsir says, the qurba here is only and only Ali, Fatima, Hassan and Hussein. Now, اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد. What is interesting, because the thought comes to mind, all the other prophets are saying, we don't want a reward. Our reward is with Allah. This prophet is saying, I want a reward. I want you to love my family. But is he asking for a reward, or is he so much higher than the other prophets that even when he's asking for a reward, he is giving? The proof is what? There is another verse of the Quran where the prophet says to his ummah, قُلْ مَا سَأَلْتُكُمْ مِنْ أَجْرٍ فَهُوَ لَكُمْ. Say, whatever I am asking you for ajr, it is for you. It is not for me. O Ummah of Muhammad, I am asking you to love my qurba because I am giving you the rope of salvation. I am giving you something by which you will not go astray. The hadith of Thaqalain is confirmed, sahih, Shia and Sunni. I am leaving behind the book of Allah and my itra, not my sunnah. The hadith that says I'm leaving the book of Allah and my sunnah is a weak hadith, da'if. The one that says my book and my itra is the one that is sahih, Shia and Sunni. In tamassaktum bihima, you hold on to these two, you will not go astray. Here it means don't just love them and recite their naat, follow them. In fiqh, in aqa'id, in every guidance, let them be your leaders. And if you were to do this, then you would not go astray. So we leave it at this, inshallah, and we will continue tomorrow, inshallah, if you can recite a salawat ala Muhammad. Sallallahu wa sallam alayka ya Aba Abdullah.
روحي وأرواح العالمين لك الفداء. يا ليتنا كنا معكم سيدي ومولاي فنفوز فوزا عظيما. Tonight is the seventh night of Muharram, and we are now paying our respects to the children of Zahra alayha salam. Last night we offered our condolences to the daughter of Zahra, Zainab alayha salam, for her children. Tonight we offer condolences to Sibtul Akbar, the son of Fatima, Hassan alayhi salam, for his son Qasim and his other sons. The Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were present in Karbala. The Ahlul Kisa were present in Karbala. Imam al-Hussein himself, as the final member of Ahlul Kisa, was there. Abu al-Fadl al-Abbas, as Shabih of Amir al-Mu'mineen, was there. Zainab alayhi salam, as Thaniya Zahra, was there. Ali ibn al-Akbar, as the exact image of Rasulullah, was there. And Hassan alayhi salam was there as his yatim Qasim. Imam al-Hassan had 4, 5, some say even 7 sons in Karbala. But we remember Qasim because he was older, he was 13, and also because of how he resembled Hassan al-Mujtaba and how dear he was to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. There were other sons of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam that we should also acknowledge and mention before we come to the masaib of Qasim. All the sons of Imam al-Hassan were martyred in Karbala. There was only one who was injured and he survived. He was called Hassan al-Muthanna and he was taken as a prisoner. And all the Hassani descendants are from Hassan al-Muthanna. And they became a large nation and they were severely persecuted, as I mentioned, by the Umayyads and the Abbasids. And they fled to many faraway lands to save their lives and to hide their identity. There was one son of Imam al-Hassan in Karbala. He was a very young boy. His name was Abdullah. The Arbab of Azar tell us that he was not to go for jihad. But when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam fell from his horse, when he fell from Dhul Jannah, this little son of Hassan was standing beside his aunt Zainab. And when he saw his uncle fall, he let go of the hand of Zainab and began running into the battlefield. Zainab alayhi salam tried to stop Abdullah, but he took off and came right into the middle of the battlefield. The Arbab of Azar said that Abdullah threw himself on the lap of Hussein. And Hussein began saying to him, "My child, you should not be out in the battlefield." At this point, we are told that Harmala came to Hussein with a sword. And as he swung the sword to Hussein, the little child lifted his arm and said, "Leave my uncle alone." And as he lifted his arm and Harmala swung his sword, he severed the arm of Abdullah so that his arm was now hanging from his elbow. The Arbab of Azar said that Abdullah began crying. He said, "Amma, they have cut my hand." Hussein hugged his child and said, "Bear patience, my child." At this point, we are told Harmala took a spear and he pierced the back of the child. Hussein placed his Abdullah beside him. Ajrukum ala Allah. But on the night of Ashura, when Hussein alayhi salam was speaking to his Ashab and Ansar, and the Ashab and Ansar began expressing their loyalty and desire for Shahada, Qasim ibn al-Hassan began thinking, "I am only 13 years old. Will I also have this honor?" So he asks Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He says, "Ya Amma, am I also one
who shall also be blessed with martyrdom tomorrow. وَأَنَا مِمَّنْ يُقْتَلْ غَدًا. To which Imam al-Husayn does not say to him, O Qasim, yes, you will be one of the shaheed. He says him, Ya Qasim, كَيْفَ الْمَوْتَ عِنْدَكَ. O Qasim, what is death to you? A 13-year-old. He says, Ya Amma أَحَلَّ مِنَ الْعَسَلِ. It is sweeter than honey. If only Qasim knew what awaits his shahadat and how Allah will accept his shahadat, so that he is the wahid shaheed whose body will be trampled while he is alive. So he asks again, Ya Amma, will I be shaheed tomorrow? Hussein again does not tell him. He says, Oh Qasim, tomorrow even your baby brother Ali ibn al-Asghar will be shaheed. To which Qasim is alarmed. He says, Ya Amma, will the enemies come into the tent? He says, No, Oh Qasim, I will take Ali ibn al-Asghar out. Ajrukum ala Allah. The day of Ashura came. Ashab and Ansar went and became shaheed. Ali ibn al-Akbar became shaheed. We are told that Qasim kept coming to his uncle Hussein. Amma, let me go for jihad. Amma, others have gone, let me go for jihad. Hussein would not give Qasim permission. The Arbab of Azah say, Qasim was kissing the feet of Hussein. Ya Amma, let me go for jihad. Hussein said, No, Qasim, you cannot go. He would kiss the hands of Hussein. My uncle, let me go for shahadat. No, Qasim, when I want to see my brother Hassan, I look at you. You are the reason I get to do ziyarah of Hassan. When Qasim despaired, he went back to his mother. He complained to his mother. Farwa remembered that when Hassan was leaving this world, he had given an amulet to her and said, Oh Farwa, keep this ta'weez with you. When the world closes on you, when there is no other way out and a great calamity befalls you, open this and you will find a short solution to what comes befalls you. When they opened that amulet, there were two letters inside. One was to his son Qasim, one was to Hussein. Qasim opened his father's letter. It said, O Qasim, when you read this letter, I will not be with you in Karbala. But O Qasim, do not hold back from giving your life. You are my representative in Karbala. Qasim was overjoyed. He took the letter of his father to Hussein. He said, Amma, my father has a letter for you. When Hussein saw the letter of his brother Hassan, he opened the letter and it said, Oh Hussein, do not stop my Qasim from going for jihad. Oh Hussein, this is my sacrifice in Karbala. Hamid ibn Muslim says, this is that one shaheed that I saw Hussein hug and cry until Hussein became unconscious. He said, I did not see Hussein faint the way he became unconscious when he cried hugging Qasim. Oh Qasim, how will I let you go? Ajrukum ala Allah. Ajrukum ala Allah. When Hussein regained consciousness, he said to Qasim, go bid farewell to your mother and the women. Qasim went into the tents. He was dressed like a groom on his wedding day. When he came before Hussein, and Hussein saw Qasim, he said to Fidda, bring me the sanduq of the tabarrukat. A chest was brought to Hussein. He opened the chest and he took out a white cloth. Then he ripped the cloth in two. He tied an amama on Qasim. Then he tied the other piece on the chest of Qasim. Do you know what Hussein is doing, O Shia of Hussein? Hussein is tying kafan on Qasim because this is one shaheed whose body will be trampled. But Hussein tied kafan on Qasim. He helped Hussein get on his horse. He helped Qasim on the horse. He bade farewell to him, Al-Wida, my son. Qasim went out for jihad. There were two mothers who, when their sons went to battle, they stood outside the tents watching their sons. One was the mother of Qasim and one was the mother of Ali ibn al-Asghar. Farwa stood outside. She is watching her Qasim. The yatim of Hassan comes into the battlefield. Hamid ibn Muslim says, when Qasim ibn al-Hassan came into the Maidan, كَانَ وَجُهُ كَشَّقَّةِ الْقَمَرِ. It was as if we were in a dark night and the full moon came out. Hi, Qasim ibn al-Hassan came out. He began his rajs and calling out. He said, إِن تَنْكِرُونِي فَأَنَا ابْنُ الْحَسَنِ. If you do not know me, I am the yatim of Hassan. سِبْتُ النَّبِيِّ الْمُصْطَفَى الْمُؤْتَمِنِ.
I am the grandson of Rasulullah. He begins fighting with the enemies. Umar ibn Sa'd says he is 13, but he is not ordinary. This is the son of Hassan. He sees one of his great commanders, Azraq bin Shami, Azraq al-Shami. He says, Azraq, go, you fight this boy. Azraq al-Shami says, it is beneath me to fight such a young boy. He sends one of his son, Qasim, sends him to Jahannam. He sends another one, Qasim, sends him to a Jahannam. He sends another son, Qasim, sends him to Jahannam. When Azraq al-Shami sees all his sons have been killed, he is enraged. He stands up. He says, I will fight this boy. Azraq al-Shami comes and fights. Qasim kills him as well. One after the other, Qasim cannot be defeated on the day of Ashura. Hamid ibn Muslim says, I was sitting with a wretched man called Amr bin Sa'ad al-Nufail al-Azdi. He looked at Qasim for a while. He said, by Allah, I will kill this boy. Hamid ibn Muslim says, I tried to hold him back. I said, oh man, such a handsome boy. His face radiates like a full moon. Why will you kill him? The man said, I will kill him to cause pain to Hussein. By Allah, I will hit him with such force that Hussein will feel the pain in his chest. This man, Amr ibn Sa'ad, came out. The coward that he was, he kept looking for Qasim from behind. At one point, we are told the strap on Qasim's sandal broke. Qasim was not tall enough for his feet to reach the stirrup of the horses. Qasim bent down to tie the sandal on, to tie the broken sandal. As Qasim bent down, Amr ibn Sa'd came from behind. He brought an iron mace with him. He hit the boy from behind. Hamid ibn Muslim says he broke the spine of Qasim. Ajrukum ala Allah. When Qasim's back broke, and he began falling from his horse, he began calling out, Wa Amma Adrikni. Hamid ibn Muslim says, every shaheed who fell, he called out once, Assalamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah. Ya Aba Abdullah Adrikni. This is one wahid shaheed who kept crying continuously, Wa Amma Adrikni. Wa Amma Adrikni. Hamid ibn Muslim says, when Adil Shuhada called out, Hussein may have lost strength in his feet. When Aun and Muhammad fell, the color on Hussein's face changed. When Abbas fell, Hussein's back broke. When Ali ibn al-Akbar fell, Hussein could not see before him. But he says, when Qasim fell, Hussein roars like a raging lion. Hamid ibn Muslim says, I never saw Hussein swoop on the enemies the way he came towards them. When Qasim kept crying, Wa Amma Adrikni, Hussein began charging at the enemies. When they saw Hussein came, Maimana ran to Maisara, Maisara ran to Maimana. A cloud of dust rose. Qasim kept crying, Wa Amma Adrikni. Hussein kept crying, my son Qasim, where are you, my Qasim? When the dust settled, the soul in Qasim's body had left. Hussein sat beside the shattered body of the team of Hassan. He began crying, Azza wallah ya Qasim, anta da'uni fala ujibak, aw ujibak fala anfa'uk. Qasim, if only you knew how it hurts you, Hussein, that you kept calling him, but he could not help you. Ajrukum ala Allah. Hamid ibn Muslim says, now Hussein had to lift the body of Qasim, but Qasim's body was shattered. His limbs, this boy whose legs would not fit the stirrup of the horse, his legs had been stretched, his arms were stretched, his bones were broken. How should Hussein lift Qasim? He says, Hussein took the head of Qasim, he took the chest of Qasim, he placed it on his chest, he took one of the boy's arms, he placed it under one arm, he placed the other hand under his other arm. Then as Hussein walked back to the tents of the women, Qasim's feet was dragging on the hot sands of Karbala. Zainab brought Farwa out. Come, O Farwa, your Qasim has come. Wa walada, wa qillata nasira. Hussein put the body of Qasim besides the body of Ali ibn al-Akbar. He sat beneath between them. He looked up to the heavens. Ya Rabbi, Hussein has lost all his sons. Wa ghurbata, وقاسمة ومظلومة.